Hey, Nerd Talk Nation, this is your host, Jordan Halstead, and my co-host, Micah Current. Micah, are you excited for this amazing, spectacular, dare I say, superior episode?
Now that you've done that, yes. You set the stage.
I did. You know, 20 years in the making for this episode. It's been out for 20 years, Spider-Man 2 with Tobey Maguire, Alfred Molina, just highly regarded as one of the greatest Spider-Man movies there's ever been. And up until, I would say, No Way Home, it was uncontested, really. I think each one is vastly different, but I think that it's kind of always been, hey, Alfred Molina playing Doc Ock and Tobey's performance in Spider-Man 2 was just really, really good. But I think that No Way Home gives it the run for its money, just based off of the fact that there's the nostalgia of all three of them coming back. You get all the villains and the actors to come back and play. Like, it was just a huge moment. So I think that's the only reason that it gives that. But we're talking Spider-Man 2. So what do you want to say about this to start this episode off?
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, you kind of covered it just to start us off, but like, what were you thinking? Like, in respect to No Way Home, what's another movie you would put in front of that? Do you think Spider-Man 2 is like number two? It was like the best of the films that are out to date?
So, I don't know.
Not that we're ranking all the movies, but like a lot of people love this film, Spider-Man 2, Tobey Maguire.
20 years and it's still regarded that way. Like, when you go in and you watch any other film franchise, typically you have people who are like, no, the next one was better, or two or three more down the line, it was way better. And this one, 20 years later, Spider-Man has been in how many films? Three Avenger films, Avenger-related films. So like 11 live-action appearances, and this is still one of the best Spider-Man films that they've got. And I'm just like, I think it's solid. I don't think that there's a bad thing about it at all.
So up against that would be No Way Home, you said.
I think No Way Home, like from a general perspective, but from my perspective, the only other movie I could throw in that direction is Homecoming, for the sole fact that I just have such fond memories of that film.
So what makes Spider-Man 2 so iconic 20 years later?
I think the cast. Playing the parts. I think that there was not a bad part in there. I think one of the biggest problems that America and Hollywood and just the climate of the world that we live in today is that, yes, we have torn down some of the walls for racial division, but I think that that's now we're so afraid of letting things stay like, and I'm not saying that it has to stay white, but like, we now switch things from, hey, MJ is a character who is your white girl who's got red hair and she's the girl next door. She's the supermodel, like all these different things that really Kirsten Dunst. I mean, she just portrayed a great MJ.
Yeah.
And that was that girl next door kind of feel. And it was a really cool way to interpret that character. And I'm not saying that Zendaya does bad with MJ at all, but it's just a very different style of character. And like, why are we so afraid of going down the rabbit trail of staying connected to the comics? And that's one of those things that, like, as a comic book fan, I just wish we would stay a little bit closer to.
Well, and even if you get into the conversation of, you know, Miles Morales, and he's an African-American. And
that and Hispanic.
And Hispanic.
Yep. But, or Cuban. Something like that.
Diverse, let's just say that. Ethnicities. Wow, I couldn't say that. But the thing that really gets me about that whole conversation is, aside from like main characters in these films, like I have IMDb pulled up on my other monitor here while we podcast, just to look at names of cast members and dates and things like that. And they've got a trailer, you know, going on in the background of like Spider-Man 2 when it happened. But if you look at it, it's like, okay, it's in New York City. everybody in the backgrounds of different races, and there's people of all nationalities.
Absolutely.
In the movie. And it doesn't have to be that their main characters have to be of different races. It's like, I think it's a package deal. I look at it as a package deal. But I think you're absolutely right. Like, it's, we're so afraid not to to be accurate with books or comics because people are going to get upset. And it's like, well,
I don't feel represented. Yes. I hate that term because I feel that if you are telling a good story, it will compel me to love that character.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I thought getting down that huge rabbit trail, like, I think that, you know, Spider-Man 2, 20 years later, you know, I was in high school when this movie came out. I remember the first one coming out, but I think I was in high school for both, and I was in college for the third one of the Tobey Maguire trilogy. And I think I would have been happy if they would have just done two and left it at that, because I'm not a huge fan of the third one. But if they would have, and it's not necessarily the acting or the dancing, as we like to make fun of Tobey Maguire's dancing in the third one, but I thought the writing was pretty bad in the third one. By the time we get to the third one, it's just like, you know, like you said, Kirsten Dunst plays a really good MJ. She plays a great MJ in the first one. She plays a great MJ in the second one. But towards the end of the second one, she starts to get on my nerves. And by the third one, it's like, seriously, do you have to make it all about you all the time? Here, Peter Parker is getting the snot beat out of him and fighting crime at night and trying to keep a job during the day and trying to, you know, pay rent and take care of his Aunt May and all these things and balancing all these plates where you're like, you know, spoiled little brat. Yeah. Spoiled little brat kind of thing, right? And so it really just gets on my nerves by the time they get to the third one. It's like she's, or Peter's supposed to have all the compassion in the world for MJ, and it's not reciprocated. So that's one of my biggest beefs.
That's hard, but I also kind of see how that works in certain areas, mm-hmm. because how real is that to life and relationships of, you know, sometimes we give it our all, but they don't really care about us.
Yes, absolutely.
And from a mental health perspective, like, sometimes you just feel like you're going it alone, and like that's hard. That's a really, really hard place to be. I've been there numerous times in my life, and I see the Peter Parker to MJ aspect, but I think there's a lot more to it.
So what makes Spider-Man 2 such an iconic film for a film that came out in 2004, 20 years ago, this June?
I think what makes Spider-Man such an iconic character, and that it kind of plays into this, is that when Stanley created this character, he designed him to be relatable. Iron Man was not like this super relatable guy. Captain America was not relatable. This kind of started a trend with Marvel Comics that, like, people could really relate to these characters, not just like them, but relate to them and see, like, oh, superheroes have problems too. And that transcends into, like, the whole, my girl that I've been in love with forever and I couldn't stick with at the end of the first movie when she found out, hey, I'm Spider-Man. Like, sometimes we have to give up the thing we want most. And I think that it translated really, really well from the idea and the comics into the movies, and him, like, going through, man, like, I messed up my one shot. Like, I needed to tell her how much I love her, and I needed to tell her that I want to be with her, and, like, going through all of that. And then to go from that portion into, how do you follow up such an iconic first movie? Like, you go through your first film together with this cast, and you had Willem Dafoe playing the Green Goblin. Like, what is a more iconic villain than the Green Goblin to Spider-Man? Like, there's really not many characters that are that high up there for him. Like, he's got a ton of characters that he faces off with, but who is just as iconic? And that's where you get Doc Ock. And
I don't want to interrupt you, but, like, I'm thinking, like, in my lifetime and in your lifetime, I'm thinking top five villains of all time. Green Goblin is in that conversation with Willem Dafoe.
Yes.
And when you thought it couldn't get any better than Spider-Man 1, you bring him back 20 years later in Spider-Man No Way Home, and he was just as good, as if not better. In that same conversation, I would have Doc Ock, Molina's Doc Ock, but then you Alfred have Thanos.
Molina. Yep.
You have Thanos, you have Darth Vader, and you have Heath Ledger's the Joker. I think that's probably the top five villains for me in my lifetime.
Absolutely.
You know, Nicholson's Joker is up there too, because it was just different than the serial killer version of Heath Ledger's Joker. It was completely different, and he was just crazy and menacing and calculating and all these things. I think the thing that made Spider-Man 2 for me was we just get to the meat of the story that they're trying to tell in the Spider-Man Tobey Maguire trilogy, right at the end of Spider-Man 1, when, you know, Green Goblin dies and he's just kind of coming into his own as Peter Parker / Spider-Man. And they really go into detail telling the story about how he goes on a field trip, he gets bit by a radioactive spider, Uncle Ben dies, Green Goblin figures out who he is. And, you know, one of my favorite scenes in that first movie is, you know, when, you know, they've graduated high school, they moved to the city, and they get to the point where I think it's like they've already graduated high school, but they've they have Thanksgiving dinner, and they have it at Peter and Harry's apartment, and Spider-Man goes to whatever that is, the Macy's Day Parade or whatever it is, the parade to celebrate Spider-Man for the key to the city or something like that. And he gets his arm cut because Green Goblin's there. And then they have dinner together, and, you know, Green Goblin is obviously, you know.
And he notices it.
Yep, he notices his, you know, the blood on his arm. And, but before, they thought Peter was up in his room. Peter's up on the ceiling, sticking to the ceiling, and that blood just hits the floor. And Willem Dafoe's character, you know, Harry Osborn, notices it. So anyway,
Norman Osborn.
I'm sorry, Harry's the son. Yep. I always get those confused. But Norman Osborn. But they just do such a great job of setting all of that up. And then, like, Spider-Man 2 comes out, and it's like, whoa, right? Like, there is really a really well-established story. And something you said earlier, Jordan, with this whole idea of casting and kind of making Spider-Man known, and how characters like Cap and Iron Man weren't known, I think it's kind of ironic that in the MCU that we know and love, Spider-Man was kind of left out because of the whole Sony rights and everything.
So, yep.
Right. And they didn't really bring him in until Captain America Civil War, which is, you know, in phase three. And so they do such a great job of setting up Tony Stank, I'm just kidding, Robert Downey Jr. as, you know, Iron Man, and Chris Evans as Captain America. And they were the faces of the MCU as we know it. But back to Spider-Man 2, the thing that really made this movie for me had to be Doc Ock. Because and how they tied it into Peter's love for science, and, you know, just this whole story about how he was able to get time with Doc Ock, and him being like this world-renowned physicist, and how they tied it into with Harry being a spoiled brat that got his dad's company and didn't really know how to balance money and corruption and all these things. And he's like, I'm going to be rich. That's all he cared about, was this, being a spoiled brat and being rich. And so he gives Doc Ock, you know, the tritium, and, you know, it ultimately, you know, turns him into Doc Ock. And I just love the design, the simplicity of his arms, the suit. What were you going to say?
I'm sorry, I'm gonna cut it in real quick.
I'm gushing over this movie, as if you couldn't tell.
I think what really makes this movie stand in 2024 above all else, because you, like you said, the villain, like, just phenomenal. The fact that Spider-Man did not create his villain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you go and you look at, like you said earlier, if you look at the MCU that we love today, and you just, like, sit back and you look at each detail, almost every single time, especially with Iron Man, all of Iron Man's villains he made, or his family made, like, everything comes back to himself. And I think that speaks to Iron Man being a very selfish person. But, like, a lot of the villains are self-made villains. Like, they face off with them. Where Doc Ock, it was an accident in science.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the safeguards broke and it just happened. Green Goblin was a test product. It was not, none of the villains that he faced were of his own design.
And what I love at the end of that film is that, you know, he helps Doc Ock destroy the tritium because it was going to destroy the city. And he was able to, bury it. And, I think he got Doc Ock's chip or whatever it was that was on the back of his neck to, you know, deactivate or whatever it was. And so, like, he was able to, you know, bring Doc Ock back to reality in respect to, knowing who he was temporarily right before he dies at the end of the movie. And so, he buries the tritium at the bottom of the river or whatever it is that was next to, I guess, the Statue of Liberty. So, we see that at the end of the movie, and that, was one of my favorite things, in respect to the dynamic between him being such a good villain. And it wasn't like your traditional villain who just went down swinging at the end of the movie. It was like they had this moment of realization of like, oh, I'm a good person and I realize what I've done is wrong. And so I'm going to take one for the team, even though I did horrible things. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that these villains, I just think that the original Spider-Man villains were really, really well done with the storytelling, because Alfred Molina's Doc Ock, he was doing things for science.
Mm-hmm.
Just straight up. And like, he loses his wife in the accident.
Well, Norman was a scientist too, like you said earlier. He's a businessman, but yeah, he was a scientist.
Exactly. And the reality of this is that if you can create a universe, and Marvel has really been bad about this, if you can create a universe where there is not a deep emotional tie of like how you created the villain, I like guys like Electro when it came to Amazing Spider-Man 2, I think that's fine that they idolized and then like it was an inadvertent creation. But when you are creating in and of itself, like Amazing Spider-Man had where like, hey, I helped create the Lizard. Not intentionally, but I helped create. I was like, yeah, that's okay. But like, I kind of wish it was just Kurt Connors who figured that out. When it comes to all these different things, I think that there are so many better ways to handle these characters. And I just don't think that Spider-Man needs to have his hand in every single one.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. It's an interesting theory. Like you have, you know, they did such a good job with both Alfred Molina and Willem Dafoe in the first two Spider-Man movies. I mean, I would even argue in the third one, as much as I didn't like that one, they did kind of the same deal because Sandman was good. And so was, why can't I think of it? Venom, like to a degree, but like I'm mad that he died, but like the whole Hobgoblin thing that they did with James Franco and Harry Osborn, that whole first scene in that movie when they're fighting in the alley and in the air, like in the skyscrapers in New York, like that's so cool. Like with the whole, the glider board and, you know.
Yeah, the glider board was sick. Oh my gosh. That was something that I was like, man, that's sweet.
I wish they would have told more of that story, but like, you know, back to Spider-Man 2, like that's something else that I enjoy is that the fact that, you know, James Franco, Harry Osborn is really all about this corporate greed. And he's also Peter Parker's friend. He's like his best friend from high school and best friend for life. And so like we get that story, but at the end of the movie, he finds out who Spider-Man is, which ends up being his best friend. And I really liked how they told that story. Like he bartered with Doc Ock to give him more tritium to finish his science experiment. But in trade, he wanted Spider-Man on a silver platter. And then he unmasks him. And it's like, oh, that moment in the theaters when I saw it, it was like, no way. Like they're going to show each other. They're going to find out who each other, you know, or I'm sorry. He's like, you know, Harry, is going to find out that Spider-Man is his best friend. Like what a moment. And yeah. Ultimately, like when we get to the third one, You know, I love it when the butler tells Harry that it wasn't Peter's fault. It was his own, the glider was the thing that killed his dad. And there was some reconciliation by the time we get to the final battle in Spider-Man 3, and he helps Spider-Man take on Venom and Sandman. And so it's like really good storytelling.
Spider-Man 2 just did a great storytelling mm-hmm. and maturing of characters that already had a great start.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just all the way across the board. I think that's how, it was great.
I know that you're a huge Tom Holland fan, as am I. But Tobey Maguire for me is probably my second, if not my first. Like, and it just depends on the day. Like I could swap out Tom Holland and Tobey, like, you know, any day of the week in regards to those movies. And one of the things that they give this cast a little bit of a hard time about is that they casted these guys and gals and they seemed older. But I think that was just the way of the world back then and just the way they casted folks. As a kid, I didn't think anything of it because, like, I think the real difference is that they're being super intentional about the Tom Holland stuff with Homecoming, he's in high school, Far From Home, he's in high school. You know, he's getting into college by the time he's done with No Way Home, all these things. And he's going to set up, you know, college Spider-Man, young adult Spider-Man, adult Spider-Man. And so, you know, you get to the point with Tobey Maguire's trilogy, it's like they try to cram all that in the very first one where they're in high school. They graduate high school, they go into the city, they're adults. And then by the second movie, they're adults. The third movie, they're a little bit older, they're still adults. But like, there's no growth and they're all adults and they look older in respect to the conversation of the cast. And that's probably one of the biggest beefs with the Tobey Maguire trilogy is that they all look older versus the Tom Holland trilogy where they look young, youthful for their age. And truth be told, they were. I mean, they truly were. They were like in their teens. You know, I think Tom Holland's what, 24 now? 23?
25.
Okay, he's 25.
26.
Oh my God. He's still super young. But I don't know. You go anywhere with this conversation, but like one of the things I really enjoyed was the story they told with Spider-Man struggling between himself and Peter Parker and not knowing if he could handle and balance both. And then it got to the point, even in the middle of the film, where he just chucks the Spider-Man suit in the trash because he's like, I can't be both. I need to be Peter Parker. And he had to have that soul searching moment of like, I need to be Peter Parker first and Spider-Man second. And I thought that was just a great story that was told. And then,
well, and that's adapted from the comics.
Yeah. And it made him stronger as a result. And then like the whole subway scene or where they're on the Amtrak and
on the train,
train Amtrak. I don't know what it was. Phenomenal. Right. And like at the end of that, when he's got the web on both sides and he's like literally like straining to keep the thing on,
literally ripping his suit
and his flesh on his arms. You see that, like the blood on his arms and stuff or his chest when he's done. The thing that really caught my attention was the people after that scene's over, they like carry him, right? And they're like, he's just a kid, right? They're not, he doesn't have like abnormal galactic, you know, space powers or anything like that. He's just a boy. Here's your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. So, so many good things about this movie.
So, 20 years later, the conversation now goes to, were you glad he showed up in No Way Home?
Who? Tobey?
Yeah.
I was like, you're going to say Doc Ock. Doc Ock, for sure.
We'll get to Doc Ock in a second, but start with Tobey.
Yeah, because he's a cool youth pastor, just like you.
Amen. Yeah. Look, when that scene hit, he's like, what are you, dressed as a cool youth pastor? Like, I was so excited because I'm literally like, I'm going to take my students to go see this here in like the next week. What if I wear a shirt that says I'm dressed like a cool youth pastor?
You don't wear cool cardigans though.
I don't.
I think that's what he was wearing in that movie. He was wearing like a cardigan.
Maybe that's what I should do.
Some jeans and maybe like a white t-shirt or something. What was the question? Was I happy that he showed up?
Do you feel like 20 years later, it's one of those things that, were you happy that he was there? Were you like, I know from a nostalgia factor, that's your Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Like, I totally understand that. I get that. But like, in the setting of the MCU, do you think that Toby is the right call to bring back? Because like, as we're now setting it up for Secret Wars, we're talking about bringing him back again. Do you think that that is the right call?
I'm going to say yes, simply because of the villains that they chose to bring back for the movie. If they would have not brought back Sandman and Doc Ock, you know, same thing with Andrew Garfield's when they brought back, you know, Lizard and Electro. Like, if they wouldn't have had the villains, I don't know that it would have made much sense. But since they did, and they picked those villains, the villains that they did, it also brought some redemption to the story. Like, if you weren't a huge fan of Spider-Man 3, which I wasn't, like, the whole Sandman story kind of got a, you know, we were able to kind of shut that chapter. And we were finally able to, get some closure on that. Honestly, I was surprised they didn't do Venom in that movie. I know they're going to do it probably later, but like,
I was about to ask that. Do you think that Topher Grace should have been in there as Venom?
No.
Do you think he would have overextended that film?
Probably. But I was thinking more Tom Hardy's Venom, not Topher Grayson's, because he was in the post-credit scene.
But Tom Hardy wasn't in anything with...
I know. I'm just saying that, like, as a villain, if they would have brought him in as a villain, like, as a new villain, and even, have your quote-unquote Sinister Six without being your Sinister Six, if that makes sense. But back to my point, I don't think that I would have... Yes, simply because of the villains and how they ran parallel with all three of their characters. All three of the Spider-Man, I should say.
I think it was good to have him the one time. I don't know that I would want him to continually come back.
He's heavily rumored to come back for Secret Wars.
I know. Him and Hugh Jackman. And I'm like, that would...
We'll see what happens with Deadpool 3.
Pass the torch. Just pass the torch.
Well, you know that all kinds of stuff's going to happen with that if that's what they end up doing.
I know.
It's also been rumored that Toby's going to get a Spider-Man 4, just like Andrew Garfield's supposed to get a Spider-Man 3. So, like, who knows?
Listen, I'm at this point, I'm like, you know, if you can put the right people in charge, and I had this conversation the other day. I don't know if it was with you or who it was with. I think Sony just needs to get rid of Spider-Man. Sony should not have the rights to Spider-Man at all. I think Disney should have it, and Disney should finish out storylines for both Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. I think that that's totally fine. I'm good with it. And like, you could easily play Spider-Man 4 as a Spider-Man No Way Home. He gets teleported back to his Earth, and then you follow up that story, and then it leads right into Secret Wars. And you could do the same thing with Amazing Spider-Man 3 if you want to bring Andrew Garfield in, or you just close it out with him and Venom, because Venom's about to have his third movie. Like, you could, I don't care how you do it. But I think that Sony just needs to give Spider-Man, not necessarily give, I mean, you pay for it or whatever. But I think the way that you make this a really sweet deal is Disney works with Sony and says, hey, if you lower the price, because it's like $4 to $6 billion, I think is what I think it was like $11 billion. So what they were asking for Spider-Man alone and all the properties that come with him. So like, if they could get everyone back under their one roof and say, hey, this is it, and then make a deal and say, all right, all Disney, Star Wars, Marvel, all of that, any video games that we do are exclusively PlayStation. I know that's going to upset a lot of people. But you say,
well, pretty much is already.
But if you go in and you say, well, Sony has Spider-Man, but if you go in and say, hey, we're going to exclusively do like Avengers games, we're going to do like all these different games, you are an exclusive partner. Like, we just want Spider-Man and his affiliate. And I'm like, man, that you could open so many stinking doors. And then the MCU would have like all the Avengers level stuff and then Spider-Man universe, but like they'd all be in one umbrella, but it's like you might get like a Spider-Man or two. movies a year, or every year you get a Spider-Man-ish movie, but it may be like, hey, we're getting a Morbius film, and then we're going to get a Kraven the Hunter film, and then we're going to get Madame Web, and like you could start setting up his side of the universe, and then you could bring in characters from the MCU over. Like, I mean, you could really make the Spider-Man side, which is your most lucrative property, I'll be honest. That like out of all the single players, Spider-Man brings in the most money, comic book and I think movie wise. So I'm just saying, the way to go.
Yeah, it's such an interesting and fascinating conversation of like what, who does what, right? And when and where and why, as you know, especially in regards to the properties of Spider-Man and for the Tobey Maguire trilogy specifically, it was solely Sony. That was pre-MCU, right?
Oh yeah.
Pre-Iron Man.
All three of them were out 2 years before Iron Man was dropped.
Yep. And something that I, you know, I'm thinking about as we're talking, Jordan, is that like, you know, now in 2024, when you think about Spider-Man, Tom Holland, you think about New York City, you think about Hell's Kitchen, you think about Daredevil, you think about all these heroes and things that are going on in New York City. It makes you wonder why they didn't tap more into that during the Tobey Maguire season, during the Andrew Garfield season. And I know that they hadn't done the Netflix universe yet, but
a lot of that comes down to rights. So they can't even allude to certain characters because they didn't have the movie rights.
Got it. Well, so that answers my question then. I think it's really interesting that, you know, had they had the rights, like where they could have gone with that. Obviously now they have so many more rights in respect to the Netflix universe, the Marvel universe, and the Spider-Man universe, all three. And so we've talked about this on other episodes where Daredevil obviously is coming out with Born Again, and you know they're saying that this stuff is canon with respect to the New York stuff and the Defenders and all these things. But it would have been cool to see, you know, 20 years ago, they did a Daredevil movie in like 2000 and it was atrocious. So we get to the point with Toby, you know, maybe he could have done that where they have Daredevil mentioned, for example, but I don't think that would have helped or hurt those movies. But, back to Spider-Man 2. One of the things
there is a nod to another character in Spider-Man 2 being with Bleecker Street. So when he's driving his little pizza scooter, he's on Bleecker Street, which is where Doctor Strange's Sanctorum is.
Got it. Well,
so there's nods to that, which is funny because who directed the original Spider-Man trilogy? Sam Raimi. Who directed Multiverse of Madness? Sam Raimi. So, like, it's cool little nods like that, and it's cool to see how things panned out over the years.
What did you think, and this is a completely random thing, and I just thought about this as we've been talking about it. What do you think about Mary Jane marrying J. Jonah Jameson's son, the astronaut?
Okay. So this is what I really wish would have happened.
I love J.K. Simmons.
J.K. Simmons. Okay. So much. That's a whole podcast of J.K. Simmons just talking about all the projects he's done. He's phenomenal. He's my favorite.
The fact that he came back for Far From Home and No Way Home was amazing. Yes. Pun intended.
Yes. Oh my gosh, it was just amazing. Yeah, so good. He's my favorite Eminem. He plays the voice. He's played since the Christmas one back in the 90s or the 80s, where he's like Santa. That's J.K. Simmons. I love J.K. Simmons. He's great. Realistically, I think that they missed a massive opportunity with bringing J.K. Simmons, being J. Jonah Jameson. If they would have brought his son in and done the Man-Wolf, I think that would have been a really cool nod, like for the third film. Even if it's just or even at the wedding, like, I got you this gift, fine. And like, he grabs onto it and like, then becomes like this werewolf that's from space. Cause it's this medallion thing that turns him into a werewolf. And it's like a really cool thing. And it would have been really weird, but for Sam Raimi, I feel like it would have fit with everything that he's done over the years. But, you know, it was kind of weird having her be with someone else. I don't really have much thought because I already know how it ends.
My favorite part of that whole scene when they're getting married in the big church in New York City is when they're playing the wedding march music and she's supposed to walk in and she's changed her mind because she wants to be with Peter. And J. Jonah Jameson looks at his wife and he's like, cancel the caviar. Cancel the caterers because he's such a cheapskate.
Oh, he is. He's such a cheapskate. Jameson. Yeah. No, I think that
something else I love about these movies, I could talk all day about these, but something else I love about it real quick is that, like, if you notice in the first, second, and third, by the time we get to the third one, his desk and his office, the Daily Bugle, like, there's more antacids and more medicines. The movies progress because he's so stressed out. So by the third one, you got Pepto-Bismol, you got Tums, and you've got Rolaids, you've got aspirin, and you've got all these
different medicines. Got everything.
Because he's got stomach ulcers and he's stressed out because Spider-Man is such a menace.
Well, and then it doesn't help that there's a point where they buzz and it, like, they like buzz in on his phone and it shakes the entire table. But like all the meds, that was cool. There was all these meds.
Yeah, they just spill everywhere.
I'm like, so funny. But I think that the casting in this film is just phenomenal. And I hate that, like, Aunt May is supposed to be like this really, really old woman, because I feel like it's just unrealistic to the character. That, like, you're that much older, because I understand, like, the point of view, like, hey, like, we see adults as older. But, like, my aunt was not that much older. Like, my aunt was like 30 years older than I am. And so it was like, she was really old in that film, but she looked very comic book accurate. And I really enjoyed that. And then by the time you, like, it was like the Curious Case of Benjamin Button kind of thing. Like, as you progress, like, oh, Aunt May just keeps getting younger and younger. So funny. But no, I thought the casting was amazing, and I loved each part of it. And I loved the dynamic that even Aunt May is willing to hit Alfred Molina's Doc Ock when he's taking her up the side of the building.
It reminds me of my grandmother every time when she's like, shame on you.
Yes, absolutely. It's just so funny.
Yeah. Any other things you want to say about Spider-Man 2? I mean, I feel like I could gush about this all day. I feel like I'm going to go watch this as soon as we hang up this call.
I know, right? I think we just need to rank it as a 20-year-old movie. Where do you rank it? 1 to 10. 10 being this amazing film, and
Where do you rank No Way Home first? What did we say about No Way Home when you did that?
Oh gosh, that's a whole other conversation.
No, I'm serious. Like, well, because you compared this to a close second.
I would say it's a 9.
No Way Home.
I think No Way Home's a 9. I think it's got some areas that it could have been better, like Topher Grace's Venom, because he knew that Spider-Man was Peter Parker.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like, just small things like that could have enhanced it. But I think that I would have said that was a 9.
So what about this one?
Probably an 8 or a 9. Like, and I'm not saying that this movie is number 2. I'm saying, I think in the general public, in their eye, I think it would come in either 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would put No Way Home up there with a 9. You know, easy 9, 9.5. And I don't know if I've ever been anything a 10. I think Guardians 3 was a 9, 9.5. But especially with it being, I just remember with the Spider-Man trilogy with the Tobey Maguire, in respect to Tobey Maguire, just the you got to think 20 years ago, CGI wasn't where it is today. And some of the effects. And the swinging around buildings, and they made New York City,
Doc Ock's arms were puppets.
Right.
They literally, the original were puppets, where the new one was, he just has to hold something on his back just for a month, for a moment, and then they can go in and fix it in post editing.
Yeah. And I think that too, that like we get to the point where I'll say I'll give it a 9. Spider-Man 2, give it a 9. But one thing I want to say really quickly too, back to the idea of, they made New York City seem like this huge high. They made Spider-Man feel, I don't know what I'm trying to say, like, because he's flying around from skyscraper to skyscraper, they made the appearance like you're looking down on New York City because that's how Spider-Man got around. I don't think they did that as much with Tom Holland as they did with.
They did more suburbs and that friendly neighborhood vibe where Spider-Man with Toby was more inner city, like hitting the skylines. And that's just that comes down to how the MCU is really starting to fit things, especially with the Netflix universe, with the street levels. Like each hero kind of had their own division. So like your Harlem hero being Luke Cage, you're the Devil of Hell's Kitchen. You had all these different characters. And so it's just some really cool ways to handle that.
Yeah, solid 9. I'm going to go 9.
Solid. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Guys, thank you so much for being a part of this this conversation and just looking at Spider-Man 2 as it is 20 years old. If you haven't seen this film, definitely go check it out. It is classic Spider-Man. It's just an amazing series. Definitely go check out all the different Spider-Mans, and that way you watch No Way Home and you know the context of all the heroes and villains in it. So with that, we'll catch you next time here on Nerd Talk.